You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Hello, Richard.
Daniel with what looks like a sock on his microphone there.
Oh, we're much more high-tech than that, surely.
It's a very nice sock.
More than one sock.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Lionel. How are you, chaps?
Strong.
Not too bad.
We've been watching the World Championships, haven't we, this past week? We've been glued to our televisions. Well, I mean, before we get on to it, and we'll have your tale of... Well, not tale of the... Well, actually, we need a tale of the title, I think, Lionel, because nobody knows what happened in the final 4 kilometres of the men's road race. It was a shambles.
Well, I'm not going to shed any more light on that, I'm afraid. I've only seen the helicopter shot, which subsequently appeared online.
It's a good way to watch it, though, wasn't it? I quite enjoyed that, the thwacking of the rotors. It was nice. You see all sorts of odd things when the action is divorced from the commentary, and how, you know, you see it as the people at the roadside see it, as just this. You don't know what's going on. I saw a guy walking his dog off to the side. Anyway,
not a great television spectacle, though, is it? No, I mean, it's a bit like snooker on the radio, cycle racing on the radio. Actually, I'll take that
Hang
back
on.
Because
we are, in effect, a radio show about cycling.
Yeah, but we're not commentating on it are we?
This is your Ratner's moment.
Nah. Yeah. That doesn't really work, because I think when cycling first was covered by the radio, it captured entire nations, didn't it? France and Italy in particular, really evocative radio commentary. Probably still does to this day in Colombia, because we hear the Colombian radio commentators when we are at the Tour de France in particular. So, yeah, no, I'll take that back. Cycling actually works as a radio broadcast sport.
Well, and actually, Lionel, that brings to mind something very interesting that the author John Foote said in our Giro special this year, about how a lot of the mystique of the Giro was lost as soon as journalists basically had to start telling the truth about what had happened, i.e. when television started covering the race, because prior to that, they could basically just say what they wanted and write what they wanted. And it was great. It was very entertaining.
Well, maybe that's what I should do. I should just invent an entire backstory of what happened in those missing 4 kilometres that weren't broadcast, in which, you know, there were multiple attacks and it all regrouped, and then another attack, and then it all regrouped. I mean, we just don't know, do we, what happened? I mean, we've got a reasonable idea.
We've got a vague idea.
Vague idea, made
all the harder by the fact that riders were in national kit rather than trade team kit. And so it was quite... I've watched it several times. Anyway, we'll get on to that. On the subject of cycling on the radio, I do recall in the opening scenes of the film The Vanishing, before the incident happens in that film, which is a very scary film, we hear the Tour de France on the radio quite a lot, and it's a sort of soundtrack to the opening scenes of the film, I seem to recall. And that,
we're one tangent away here from Mariah Carey and a Vitalicio Segura's
This is a relevant tangent, because that book, it was adapted from a book written by Tim Krabbe, the author who wrote, obviously, a very famous book about cycling as well. Anyway, I wanted to say, before you go on to the news roundup, Lionel, that Bergen looked absolutely magnificent. I was very sorry I wasn't there, but it was a perfect size of city. I think we talked about Nîmes as a perfect size of start city for the Vuelta. That the World Championships in Bergen looked absolutely perfect. The crowds were enormous. The place was beautiful, and I thought it was a huge success, certainly watching it on television.
It definitely was. It looked beautiful. I mean, Scandinavia at this time of year the weather could have been anything, couldn't it? There were a few spots of rain in some of the other races, but for Sunday's race, it was glorious, and all the coastline looked fantastic, the buildings looked fantastic, and the way that the roads that they selected for the course, you know, looked particularly from the air. It was a beautiful event to watch. I watched all six or six and a half hours of it on Sunday, which did make the loss of the television pictures right at the end quite frustrating. But
just a little bit.
A little bit frustrating. That, but there we are. That's bike racing, isn't it? And that's the way the cookie crumbles sometimes. But let's just recap what happened over the course of the week. Of course, the big story was that Peter Sagan of Slovakia won the world road race title for the third year in a row. That's he's the first rider to win three road race rainbow jerseys in a row. He won in Richmond in the USA 2 years ago and in Doha last year. And this year, well, it was the Ala Zubeldia of world championship victories. We really didn't see him. It's not an exaggeration to say we didn't see him all day. But then when the group came together and they came around the corner and it was obvious that it was going to be a little group sprint, he came surging forwards along with Alexander Kristoff, the Norwegian, and obviously a home favourite. They were neck and neck at the line. Peter Sagan's bike throw won it. Michael Matthews was in third place for Australia. We keep referring there to the pictures being lost. Unfortunately, due to a power cut, we believe, the cameras lost. The motorbike that was covering the lead group lost pictures with around 4 kilometres to go, and so there was a really excruciating few minutes of watching the finish straight, and so we didn't really know what was going on in that gap. At that point, Julian Alaphilippe was still away. He'd been away with Gianni Moscon of Italy. Moscon was later disqualified because he had been captured on camera holding on to the Italian team car. We'll probably talk about that a little bit later in the episode. The day before, the men's race was the women's race, and the Dutch dominated it, really. They had three riders in the final winning break, and it was Chantal Black who won the rainbow jersey ahead of Katrien Garfoot of Australia, who added the silver medal to the bronze that she'd won in the time trial earlier in the week. The defending champion, Amelie Dideriksen of Denmark, was third. The men's under-23 race was won by Benoit Cosnefroy ahead of Leonard Kamner. A little bit of controversy there, with Kamner being a Sunweb rider riding in the World Tour and then still being eligible for the under-23 race. We may discuss that a bit later too. The junior races were won by Elena Pironi of Italy and Julius Johansson of Denmark. The other big event of the World Championship week was the UCI presidential election, and David Lapassion won by 37 votes to 8 ahead of the previous incumbent Brian Cookson. It's been announced that World Tour and Pro Continental riders will have a rise in the minimum wage that the teams are required to pay them. It hasn't changed since 2013, but World Tour riders will now have a minimum wage of €38,115 a year. That's up from €36,000, and the Neo Pros will get €30,855. However, there's still no movement on introducing a minimum wage for women riders. Away from the World Championships, we did hear this week that the 1987 Vuelta winner, Luis Herrera, who was the first Colombian to win a Grand Tour, has been diagnosed with skin cancer. And he has put that down to spending a lot of time outdoors riding in the sunshine.
Yeah, very sad news. He was also the focus of our Kilometre Zero at the Vuelta. Was it the first one that we did? I look back on his Vuelta win in 1987. So very sad news about Lucho Herrera. We wish him well. Yeah, I mean, lots of racing. The most clear-cut victory over the week in Bergen was certainly Lapartion beating Cookson in the UCI presidential race. We'll talk about that in the final part, I think. On the men's road race, first of all, I mean, that's something that interests me about it. Well, two things, actually. Watching that helicopter footage, Lionel, it cleared up a lot in terms of Peter Sagan and the way that he rode those final stage of the race. Because if you just saw the race up to 4 kilometres ago and then the finish, you'd have said, well, the only time I saw Peter Sagan all day was in the final 200-300 metres of the race. Actually, in the final 4 kilometres, he was quite active. There were moments when he was chased down Ben Swift at one point, Gaviria at another point. He did appear to be quite active. Interesting, Michael Matthews saying that he thought he'd done too much on the climb. Didn't see much of Sagan on the climb, but Sagan seemed to be quite active on the run-in. A masterful piece of riding by him. He sort of manoeuvred himself from Matthew's wheel onto Christoph's wheel in about the final 400-600 metres of the race, just before the penultimate bend. And that was the moment. He obviously noticed that Christoph was preparing to go quite early, and he did go very early, Christoph, and rode extremely strongly. And it was very close in the end. But one thing, a question for you, Daniel, because we've talked in the past about the World Championship Road Race often being more exciting because there's no history to races on the course. So there are more riders who perhaps think they can win. There's no kind of formula to winning. Peter Sagan has struggled to win major one-day races despite the talent that he has. His only major one-day race, major, you know, monument, is the Tour of Flanders a couple of years ago. And yet, he's won 3 World Road Race Championships on the bounce. What do you put that down to? Why is it the World Road Race Championship that is the one-day event that appears to suit Peter Sagan
best?
Well,
first of all, Rich, just to underline how special that achievement is. I mean, I was looking at the number of riders who have won monuments 3 times in a row, and there's a very, very tiny number. Eddie Merckx won Liège-Bastogne-Liège 3 times in a row in the 70s. Moreno Argentin did it in the 80s. And the other monuments, there's only Francesco Moser, I think, and Octave Lapiz won Paris-Roubaix 3 times in a row. Otherwise, no one has achieved that feat in any of the other monuments. I've got a bit of a theory about Sagan and the World Championships that, one, the weakness of his team in a perverse way sort of plays in his favour, because it is so weak. And okay, his brother has supported him well in the World Championships that he has won, and a couple of other riders, but it is so weak that it doesn't really encourage the other teams to race purely against him and to really make him the focus of their efforts in the same way as he is, for example, in the classics. We've seen him and we've heard him in the last couple of years complain a lot in the classics about people riding against him. No one really does that in the World Championships. The other reason they don't do that, I think, is that he's still beatable on every kind of terrain. I would say apart from maybe the sort of punchy 1-2 kilometer climbs at the finish, where everyone in the peloton would say, right, we don't want to take Sagan to that kind of finish. There are a lot of guys who still think they can beat him in a sprint. And in fact, if you look at the top 10 from Sunday, pretty much all of those guys would say that on their day, they can beat Sagan in a sprint. And the same applies to, well, dropping him on the climbs. There are a lot of guys in the peloton who think that they can drop him on the climb, so they don't necessarily make him the focus of their efforts, and they're quite happy to go into the last lap of a World Championships with him still there. They, you know, Kwiatkowski thinks he can drop him, or he thinks he might even be able to beat him in a sprint. Matthew's the same, and so the, you know, he can, oddly enough, slip under the radar to a certain extent, and still be there with all of his racecraft and all of his mastery that gets him onto the right wheels when other people sort of go astray and awry in the last few hundred metres.
There was the rumour that we mentioned in last week's podcast that he was ill, of course. Was that just a bluff, we wonder? Just, I mean, on what you say there, Daniel, the other thing that should be noted is that the 3 World Championships that he's won have all been on courses that have really suited him. I mean, he won in Richmond on his own, and it was a similar course to Bergen, really, with a little, you know, not serious climbing, testing, but not serious. Qatar last year was obviously not hilly, but the crosswinds made it tough and attritional. And of course, the distance makes it attritional. And he's very good, it seems, the longer the race goes on, the more, you know, while some of the really fast guys, their speed is maybe blunted a bit, Sagan seems to just be able to maintain that edge that he has.
But again, Rich, if you remember, there was a period in his career, early in his career, when there was a serious doubt over his ability in long races. And in fact, you know, again, to this whole theme of him still not seeming invincible, you know, there was that period in 2014, 2015, where he was finishing second a lot and he was getting beaten by people like Greg Van Avermaet a lot in sprints and couldn't win a Tour de France stage. You know, it may be that even that is still fresh in memories, and people still have this idea of him, as I say, of of him as being beatable. And yeah, if you look at his record, particularly I noticed in the last 2 years, his record in sprints, in just pure bunch sprints, is improving all the time. And it's getting to the stage now where, you know, you have to really consider him one of the top three or four bunch sprinters in the world. And no one really, apart from those top three or four, have any right to think that they are going to beat him or are likely to beat him in a bunch sprint. So they have to get rid of him first. But I think that's taken a while to really sink in with a lot of riders and a lot of teams and national teams.
I don't think sorry, Lionel.
Well, I was just going to say, it also wasn't raced in a way that made it selective from, you know, two or three laps out. There wasn't a kind of breaking down in the last couple of laps or the last couple of times up Salmon Hill that would have teased Sagan out and put to the test whether or not he had been suffering, feeling a bit under the weather in the days leading up to the race. It was, there was that kind of the stealthy move that went clear, and then before it all came back together, you know, it was dangerous, but it was never dangerous enough to really force the big top riders to react. Nobody really had to react, and in fact, even when Alaphilippe went, nobody really reacted, did they? It was a case of knowing that there was probably enough of a descent and enough of a run-in from the climb to the line for it all to come back together. They just kept the pace high enough to keep it together and really played into Peter Sagan's hands, you know, and didn't sort of put him under any pressure at all.
Well, I mean, we should also say, Lionel, further to, you know, why Sagan is being allowed to get into winning positions. He was lucky on Sunday in the sense that Denmark did him a lot of favours in the way that they rode the finale. In fact, I think without the work of the Danish riders, and in particular Valgren, Alaphilippe and Moscon, and probably Alaphilippe on his own, would have gone to the finish. And, you know, that also comes down to the prestige of the World Championships, how desperate people are to win. You know, how many guys know that it's a life-changing opportunity? Well, it would be a life-changing victory for them. So, you know, whereas in other races, they might be willing to play a bit of poker and, you know, see who's going to work and play a waiting game. That's not really the case in the World Championships. And again, Rich, that's another reason that has probably played, well, it's another factor that's played in Sagan's favour, that, you know, people will chase and they will, and any race where there are a lot of people willing to chase, the odds are that it's going to come back together in some form, and it's going to be some kind of sprint. And that's what's happened in, well, certainly two of his World Championships.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring us throughout 2017. A reminder that you can get 20% off all your Science in Sport goodies at scienceinsport.com by entering the code at the checkout, CPAUG20, CPAUG20. And yeah, thank you to Science in Sport. We are, of course, very grateful to them. Just carrying on the discussion around the men's road race. I mean, Julian Alaphilippe, when I watched the footage, the missing footage of the final 4Ks, I mean, it was absolutely unbearable on Sunday watching the red kite, waiting for the riders to appear and not knowing whether it was going to be Alaphilippe on his own, Alaphilippe with Moscon, though he dropped Moscon earlier, or a group, and it was a group. Well, Valgren was just off the front at that point, wasn't he? But it was tantalising. I mean, Alaphilippe, a really, really strong attack from him, and as you say, Daniel, he was foiled by, you know, the riders behind, just desperate to get something out of the World Championships, not necessarily working in the interests of. You know, it wasn't really clear what the strategy was. It was just a sort of air of desperation about
it. Yeah, and the blackout, Rich, was even more unbearable, I think, for the French or France 2 commentary team, because they'd pretty much proclaimed him the world champion as he, well, within 30 seconds or so of his attack, they were absolutely convinced, Laurent Jalabert, Marion Rousse, I forget the name of the lead commentator, but they were absolutely convinced that he was away and that he was going to win. But the French the French strategy was interesting in the sense that they had three riders, Brian Coquard, Nasser Bouhanni, and Arnaud Démare, none of whom were selected, who I thought on paper would have been well suited to that route. You know, fast riders, all of them, who on their day can climb pretty well. And for various reasons, quite nebulous reasons, it seems to me, Cyril Guimard, who's the returning, the veteran coach, director sportif, has brought in as the French national selector this year, didn't want to go with them and went with Alaphilippe. Alaphilippe was going to be the sole leader. And the French rode pretty well, apart from that they missed the break with about 60 kilometres to go, so had to do quite a bit of work to pull that back. And at that point, I thought, you know, when that break was away with Tim Wellens in particular riding well at the front, I thought, yeah, this is going to be a hard race now. And this is a perfect move for Belgium because it's going to harden things up for Gilbert and Van Avermaet behind, and it might get rid of people like Gaviria and so forth. It didn't. But having said that, Galopin attacked at the bottom, or he tried to attack at the bottom of Salmon Hill to sort of soften it up for Alaphilippe to go. And yeah, it worked perfectly, but it was just a couple of kilometres too far for him, wasn't it? I mean, I thought he did the right thing when he dropped Moscon. Moscon was sort of slowing slightly and they were about to get caught, and he went again, Alaphilippe, with about 4 kilometres to go, wasn't it? But then Moscon came back. But I don't really think he could have done too much more, Alaphilippe. And certainly bodes pretty well for future world championships and, well, future years for Alaphilippe.
Well, next year perhaps. I think we can be pretty sure Peter Sagan will not win 4 in a row, because it looks in Innsbruck next year to be a climber's race, and it could be one that suits Alaphilippe. I think it was Philippe Gilbert who tried to go with Alaphilippe, wasn't it? I mean, Alaphilippe out Gilberted Gilbert. I mean, that's exactly the sort of thing Gilbert would have done a few years ago and has been doing this year. But that was a measure of just how well Alaphilippe was going. Moscon then jumped across and got there. Now, controversy about him again, of course, after the incident earlier in the year of the using racist language against Kevin Reza at the Tour de Romandie. And we've talked about that incident. We don't want to bracket them together, but two pretty big controversies for him, young rider this year. It did emerge, as you said, Lionel, earlier, that he had held on to the Italian team car. His Italian director, Davide Cassani, has taken responsibility for that. But nevertheless, you know, whether he was told to hold on or not, he did hold on. And I think what bothers me most about that is that he could have won the race. You know, he went on to attack, and he was in a race winning position. I think that we know that holding on to cars goes on, shouldn't, but it does. But it's rare that somebody does that and then goes on to have such an impact on the race. I think. I mean, we don't know that for sure, but you know, there aren't too many certainly documented cases of that. There will be more now with mobile phones and so on. But
well, Arnaud Démare, yeah, of course, when he won Milan-San Remo, was accused of having held onto a car at a critical point of the race, and then went on to win that race. And there was no actual footage of that incident, was there? There wasn't, was there? We didn't see any of that. No. I mean, no. It was an allegation by
Tezzato.
That's right, wasn't it?
Yeah,
who said that Démare basically came past him holding onto the car. This is an incident where, again, you know, it's been filmed, and I think we know that riders hold on for longer than they should do when taking a bottle. I mean, it's as old as the hills, that tactic of just, you know, giving the legs a little bit of a break when taking a feed from the car. But this seemed to be more of a, you know, trying to give Moscon some momentum to get back on after he'd had a problem. And it was in a critical part of the race. It was inside the final 40 kilometres. And I think, you know, there's a sense, isn't there, that you don't take advantage, you don't take the mickey to avoid an alternative of that would involve a swear word. And Moscon took the mickey. It was too close to the finish. It was too long, the holding onto the car, and you know, the fact that he was spotted meant that the decision was simple to disqualify him. And it's another it's another mark against him, isn't it? It's not in the same category. It's not the same type of incident or misdemeanor as using racist language. Far from it. It's far less serious in the grand scheme of things. And so it's quite ironic, really, that the use in terms of the UCI's penalties, Moscon was penalised more harshly for holding onto a bottle for 7 or 8 seconds than he was for using racist language.
Yeah, that's a good point. As you say, it was. It's interesting that quite. That you mentioned Damar at Milan Sanremo, there was no footage of that. That's the difference, isn't it? And I think as mobile phones, they're pretty ubiquitous and have been for a few years anyway, but there are going to be fewer and fewer hiding places for things like this to go on. Fewer places that are out of range of being shot by somebody somewhere, either by the side of the road or in a team car. And so you really are taking a huge risk doing that, and he's been caught in the right decision. But had he gone on to win the race or even win a medal, it would have blown up into a big controversy, I imagine.
Even when we talk about it now, Rich, we're talking about, or Linus talking about, not taking the mickey, which suggests that, you know, there are still big grey areas. I mean, I think there've been four or three pretty high profile incidents this year, with Bardet being kicked out of Paris-Nice, Domon and Genies being kicked out of the Vuelta, and this incident, and they will help to clear things up in riders' minds about what is and what isn't acceptable. But there is still an area of, well, there's a nebulous zone whereby, you know, it's 2 seconds okay, is a sticky bottle okay, well maybe it's okay, you know, as long as you don't get caught. And that's the issue. There is a suspicion that the moral line for a lot of riders, a bit like it used to be once was with doping, it's more to do with whether they get caught than whether they actually commit the offence. And just to underline that, Davide Cassani's statement, the Italian national team selector director, his statement, he said that he took complete responsibility for it, wasn't Moscon's fault. Well, you can only really take the responsibility if there are any consequences to bear, and in Cassani's case there's been no disciplinary action. I mean, it's talk is cheap, I think, in this case. And he also said that he thinks 20 other director sportives all would have done the same thing, which suggests that he's not contrite about it in any way, and what he regrets is having been caught. And, you know, I think that's poor from a national team selector. You know, you're representing a country, your federation is funded by taxpayers' money effectively, and I think that's pretty shoddy.
Yeah, I mean, who am I to condemn somebody unreservedly for holding on to a car? Of course, it does go on in bike races.
It does,
but,
Rich.
I mean, but in very different circumstances. It was
for anyone,
Lionel,
who's unfamiliar with this story, you got kicked out of the RAS in Ireland.
1996
for holding on to a team car. But you were.
I didn't go on to attack and try and win the race. I in fact got off the bike and climbed into the car and
launched
my journalism career.
Yeah, I don't want to single out Italy either here, but I mean, anecdotally, if you talk to people who've raced as sort of juniors and under 23s, in particularly under 23s in Italy, I mean, you know, the holding onto the team car competition is almost as keenly fought at one end of the race as the race for the podium is at the other end. I mean,
something that it was interesting, Lionel, in the reaction to the Moscon incident among Italians and on social media and elsewhere as well in the press. This is something Italians are constantly, well, have to tackle this image of them of being sort of, you know, they're always looking for shortcuts, always trying to be smarter, always trying to get one over on other people. And they don't like that stereotype. They don't like that cliche. And this was a particular reason why Davide Cassani and the Italian Federation were being urged to make a statement, take some kind of action. And you know, there were a lot of Italians who said that it looked very bad for that particular reason, that it reinforced that stereotype.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to go on about this too much, but there is, you know, a sticky bottle. If a rider is in a break and drops back to the team car, I think a sticky bottle in that situation is okay, because it's just getting you back up to where you were in the break. But there's a line, and I'm not really sure where the line is. And I don't know if you can even define what the line would be or how long the sticky bottle can last for, or, you know, there's also the element of, as we saw with Nibali,
how sticky can the bottle, how is it, you know, Pritt stick,
yeah,
Poppy Dex or Loctite?
Yeah, super glue. Anyway, moving on from that to a race that some people have called, including Mark Cavendish. Mark Cavendish, we interviewed him for the recent cycling podcast Femina because Ashley Moolman-Passio had praised him for his support of women's racing on social media and so on. And Cavendish reckoned that the women's race on Saturday was the best of the road races. Some people didn't agree with that. It was a tactical affair. I mean, I guess what we talk about often with the World Championships is national teams coming together. How will those riders who would ride for other professional teams the rest of the year work together? And we often see at World Championships that perhaps because there are divided loyalties and perhaps because they don't ride together very often, team strategies often don't work. There are rare examples of it working very well, such as when Mario Cipollini won his world title 2003. He had a very 2002. He had a very united Italian team working for him. There were about
60 of them as well, if you remember, back in those days.
Yeah, okay.
The best teams in the world.
Half the fields were Italian.
What was it, 12 yeah. or 13? I think maybe 13 riders if they had the champion. Anyway.
Yeah. Odd. Anyway, we knew that going to the women's road race on Saturday that the Dutch team were the strongest on paper. The question was whether the likes of Annemiek van Vleuten and Anna van der Breggen would be able to work together. They were the strongest two in the time trial as well, and I think they were the strongest two in the road race. And I thought it was fascinating from a tactical point of view how it worked out, because the sort of the wild card on that team, Chantal Black, or one of the wild cards, Marianne Vos, was there as well. And, you know, how unusual it is to see a world championship with three Dutch women all finishing very high up and Marianne Vos not being one of them. But Chantal Black went away early. She did the sort of Tim Wellens move in that race, ostensibly softening up for her leaders, making other teams chase. She went away with Hannah Barnes, who was in a couple of moves and rode extremely well in the road race, and Audrey Cordon-Ragot, and they had quite a lead going into the final climb. On that climb, Anna van der Breggen and Annemiek van Vleuten put a lot of pressure on. Van der Breggen in particular looked very strong. It all came back together. And it was, you know, textbook stuff from Chantal Black. She then launched a move. She was the one that the others weren't so bothered about. She got away and won the race. And, you know, she's a very strong rider, rides for Bols Dolmans. She's a teammate there with Anna van der Breggen. And not the expected winner, not somebody that a lot of people predicted would win. Certainly not even the most fancied rider in her own team. But nonetheless, a very deserving winner, I thought.
Well, it was a tactical plan A, wasn't it? Because with Van Vleuten and Van der Breggen in that group, the Dutch, they had three strong cards to play. It was logical that Chantal Black would be the first to go. And, you know, when nobody reacted, that was that. Because then it was always going to be very difficult for one rider to pull it back together. Anyone taking the initiative to lead the chase from that group was going to ruin their own chances and succeed only in setting up either Van Vleuten or Van der Breggen. So the others all needed to work together, which they did to a degree, but there wasn't the kind of commitment to chasing Black that there needed to be, obviously. And it was basically putting laying a sort of 10 of hearts down on the table and saying beat that, and nobody did, and knowing that there was an ace and a queen in the group behind. So, you know, it was an interesting tactical race. It was certainly more of a watch than the men's race, I thought, because there were sort of interesting phases to it. The move that Hannah Barnes was in was interesting, and there was all the kind of the waiting, the watching behind, and knowing that they still had the climb to come, and wondering what kind of damage that climb would do, and in actual fact it didn't really do a great deal of damage, because everyone got over it, you know, pretty well. The group was big, everyone came back up, didn't they? I suppose the problem for everybody else was that they just didn't have teammates that the Netherlands team had. You know, that was a real kind of embarrassment of riches, really. You know, if a nation like, say, the United States had had two or three other riders who could have committed to some sort of chase, then, you know, you would have seen them really trying to bring it back together for Corin Rivera, I guess. And then everybody else, you know, was kind of on more or less on their own. So a tactical masterclass, but really, when you look at their lineup, so it should have been.
Absolutely. On the racing, the other thing you mentioned in your news roundup, Lionel, was the under 23 Stussy controversy, if we can call it that. I think we might all be in agreement on this, about whether World Tour riders should contest the under 23 world title. Interestingly, looking at social media and so on, within the sport, people who work in the sport seem almost united that World Tour riders should not be allowed in the under 23 road race. But I think we are in agreement.
We're not, Daniel. All in agreement.
No. All right. Sorry, I didn't read the signs properly. But I cannot get my head around an argument that says that an under 23 rider who rides at World Tour level should be excluded from the title race. Albeit, some of the riders who rode the senior race, such as Gaviria, could have ridden the under 23 race. I think he's still eligible. But he chose not to, and it's a choice. And I think an under 23 race where some under 23 riders were excluded would be a sort of devalued event.
I mean, the under 23 category it's a sort of portmanteau for an amateur category, isn't it?
Under 23 means
under the age of 23. I get that.
It means under the age of 23.
But that's how it originated. I mean, am I wrong? Up until 2005, there were no professionals allowed, or no professionals as we understand them today. So, Continental Division Pros.
It evolved from the old amateur title.
World Tour Pros, certainly, and then now we've got World Tour Pros as well. The under 23 scene, you know, is its own scene, and it's really the sort of nursery slopes for professional cycling. And the World Championships was the event, the grandstand finale to the under 23 season, where everyone came together from their very strong respective scenes in Italy and France and Spain. And, you know, it was their big sort out at the end of the year. And I thought that's what its purpose was. That's what it was supposed to be. And I think muddies the waters a little bit to throw in World Tour riders. I don't think, you know, the purpose of it is not to find out who is the best rider in the world under the age of 23. I think it's the purpose is,
don't call it the under 23 world championship then.
Yeah, I'm with Richard on this. I mean, yes, this is all focused around Lennard Kamner, who's ridden for Team Sunweb this season. He completed the Vuelta. He was part of the Sunweb team that won the team time trial at the start of the world championship week. So obviously he's had a level of racing that many of the others in the field haven't had all year, but there are others in there as well. I mean, Benoit Cosnefroy has been a stagiaire with AG2R, not just this year, but last year as well. He won a race, a French one-day race, the week or 2 weeks before the World Championship. So he's been competing against, you know, fully blown professionals, some of whom will have been World Tour. Albanese, who was fifth, rode a couple of weeks of the Giro for Bardiani. So, I mean, if you're going to...
Well, exactly.
Focus all came down to Kamner, but the point is that the category is under 23, and if you are under 23, you should be eligible. If the whole point is to kind of provide a pathway for young riders to make it from basically the sort of semi-pro ranks to the World Tour ranks, then it seems absolutely logical to me that a sprinkling of World Tour riders is going to enhance that process. It means that you can see, you know, you otherwise you could say, well, 19-year-olds or 21-year-olds shouldn't compete against against people who are 22 and 11 months. I mean, it's you know, the category is the category. It's been arrived at, you're absolutely right, it's been arrived at, as so many things in world cycling, by a kind of series of, you know, compromises and decisions that perhaps haven't been thought out with sort of 10 or 20 years of the future in mind. You know, this category only really was invented because the old amateur category had to go once the kind of professional category went and everything went elite, and so professionals were then allowed into the Olympic Games in 96. It's all a kind of legacy of kind of, you know, half-assed decisions taken here, there and everywhere. But I think under 23, it's pretty clear what that is. And if Gaviria had wanted to ride and won it, well, then that would have, you know, you could say, well, that's a soft win for Gaviria, but he chose not to ride because he thought he had a stab at the elite race.
And it's nonsense. Yeah, it's nonsense, Lionel. It's a nonsense, Richard. I mean, can you remember when it's like when Christophe Reneiro won the Tour de l'Avenir a month after finishing fourth in the Tour de France in 1998. You know, that was rightly shown up. It was rightly shown up.
And
to
he
be
was
a nonsense.
He was eligible to do so.
And the rules subsequently changed, and so they should change in this. It's rubbish.
I like it. I think you're just sort of inventing an argument here.
I think we could, as long as the UCI run the start list past Daniel Freeb next September, it's all going to be fine. But I think this is focused on one rider, really. Kamna, who's ridden the whole season for a World Tour team. He's ridden a Grand Tour. But then, you know, what if you're a pro continental rider in a team that gets a wild card for the Vuelta?
Or what if you're a rider who has actually built his entire season around the under 23 World Road Race Championship, whereas Kamna has been riding the Vuelta and riding the team time trial, and his primary role and responsibility this year has been working for his team. You know, I mean, that's a sort of slight handicap as well. The rider who's able to, and let's face it, if you win the under 23 world title, regardless of what team you ride for, chances are you're then going to turn pro with a World Tour team anyway, and not, because the other point to this, you're not going to wear the world champion's jersey.
Oh, that was an absolutely nonsense strand to this whole argument. I mean, Cosnefroy is not going to wear the jersey, is he? Because he's turning pro for
plenty of riders have won the World Under 23 Championship in the past and stayed amateur for another year and worn the rainbow jersey. That's happened on numerous occasions.
Hey.
Which is entirely their choice. But if you're eligible, change the category then. Don't call it under 23. Come up with some ridiculous, tortured definition for who
Espoirs.
Is and who
Just
isn't
call it
eligible.
Espoirs.
Espoirs.
You know, the world of professional cycling is about to...
Espoirs brackets, as long as you're not in a World Tour team.
Well, we've dedicated more energy to this, you know, barely contentious issue than anything else, I think, probably. But it's a bit, yeah.
Leave it.
Hey, it's Hannah Barnes, rider for Canyon SRAM Racing Team, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. My favourite ride was this year on New Year's Day. We rode for 5 hours to the top of this 20k climb and back down, and Mar de Dei Del Mont, it's called. The weather was really amazing. I love Rafa because they ask us for feedback on items, and they always are curious in what we think of the products, and they spend a lot of time making us comfortable and, yeah, just helping us enjoy training and racing.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Yes, thank you, of course, to our title sponsor, Rafa, without whose support we wouldn't be able to bring you these podcasts. And they have allowed us also to cover all three Grand Tours this year, of course, the Giro, the Tour and the Vuelta. We'll be looking at the Giro route in more detail when it is announced. And we had... Our Lady in the Desert, Hannah Troop, out in Israel for the confirmation last week that the Giro will start there next year, and she has filed a special report. We'll hear that when we talk about the Giro route when it's unveiled, which is usually the day after the Tour of Lombardy, isn't it, Daniel?
Yes, it usually is. Yes.
Well, that should be in a couple of weeks. Lionel, I'm surprised in all that we're going to talk about the UCI presidential election, but I'm surprised in all the chat about the racing that you haven't mentioned Hertfordshire's second best Irishman, who, of course, featured in the break, in the early break on Sunday in the men's road race.
Yeah, I'm not sure he'll enjoy that description of Hertfordshire's second finest Irishman. Conor Dunn. They had two riders in that break, and they were out there for quite a long time, or not far off half the race, I think. And as Hertfordshire's number one Irishman, I was enjoying watching that.
he knows how to sniff out a break, doesn't he, Conor Dunn? He did it a lot at the Vuelta. Still got to get a Pedlar de Charme t-shirt to him, actually. Just before we move on to UCI election again, a lot of you were asking, and I don't think we mentioned this last week, about Mark Beaumont and his round the world exploits. He's set a new world record for riding around the world in 78 days, I think, which is, somebody pointed out on Twitter, has kind of ruined the title of the book, which I'm sure he's going to write. But a lot of you have asked about whether we'll, you know, be speaking to Mark. Not really. It's not, what he does doesn't really fit with our usual diet of coverage of professional cycling. But he is a really fascinating guy, and I know him very well. And he talks very well about his exploits. And I'm meeting him in a couple of weeks.
Well, we should invent something to accommodate that chat.
Oh, of course, we will. We will be putting something out with Mark Beaumont in the near future. So the UCI presidential election, are you both still there?
Yep.
Yeah. Riveting.
No,
riveting.
I mean, hey, listen, Brian Cookson, the only UCI president in history ever to not serve at least one term, which...
Yeah, but in the past, I mean, people were president for sort of 10, 15, 20 years sometimes, and it was one of those things where... that they had to sort of stand down or kind of shuffle off to the side of the stage before they were replaced. I mean, it's become a lot more political in recent years, particularly with the way that Brian Cookson sort of ousted Pat McQuaid in the first place 4 years ago.
Yeah, and a very similar thing has happened to him, really, on the face of it, where an insider, somebody who he worked with at the UCI and former head of a federation, as he was, has... stood against him. Now we're going to speak to Brian Cookson at some point over the next few weeks or so, and we'll, you know, interview him. Lionel, you certainly been trying to interview him for a while on various things, but it's worth maybe just stepping back a little bit and looking at this early stage, at what Brian Cookson achieved, what he maybe didn't achieve, some of these are difficult at the moment to assess. Also, we can talk about the reasons why he lost. I mean, the background, I suppose, to his bid for UCI president. You know, he was the president of British Cycling for many, many years, pretty much two decades. He oversaw the growth of that organization, the huge success that organization had through the Sydney Olympics, the Athens Olympics, the Beijing Olympics, the London Olympics. And he was really riding a wave of British success as he came into office. The question that maybe wasn't asked was he actually a suitable candidate to be a president of a world governing body? And I guess I've always found Brian Cookson to be a very decent man. I have never been struck by his leadership qualities. I think his success at British Cycling owed a lot to the fact that he let Dave Brailsford and Shane Sutton get on with it. Now, you could argue that that's also what led to the alleged culture of, I'm going to use the words, bullying and ruthlessness, certainly, in the organisation, because Dave Brailsford and Shane Sutton were fully in charge of that team. Brian Cookson let them get on with it. That was why they were, I think, so successful. But it's not necessarily a testament to Brian's leadership qualities. And I think ultimately that's perhaps what cost him the job at the UCI. But running through his record, which is still evolving, I suppose, but I would put, I've done a couple of columns of hits and misses, and, you know, he oversaw the introduction of the Women's World Tour. he appointed Tracy Godfrey to office at the UCI, and she was instrumental in that. It's not a perfect in its execution at all, the Women's World Tour, but it's nevertheless, I think, progress. I think he restored dignity to the office. We can forget quite easily, I think, just what it was like under Pat McQuaid and Hein Verbruggen, who were constantly, it seemed, at war with the likes of WADA, which, you know, you don't want to see a governing body at war with WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, at war with ASO, organiser of the Tour de France. UCI was, it did appear at times to be a bit of a basket case, and I think under Brian Cookson, it has not appeared that. He also commissioned the CERC report into cycling's doping culture, a brave thing to do. The CERC report was a very detailed document. Whether all the things that were contained in that were followed up on is another question, but to publish that, to commission it and publish it, was certainly something that Brian Cookson promised to do and did. And in the Mrs. column, I suppose I've put CERC report follow-up, because the report was published and not aware of an awful lot of action coming out of it. The World Tour reforms, a bit of a shambles. Ignoring the Women's World Tour, the Men's World Tour, the number of events, the explosion in events and clashes and so on, to me it's not coherent at all. The leadership thing I've mentioned, the relationship with ASO, it's not really better or worse than it was under Pat McQuaid. The impression you're left with is that the ASO regard the UCI as an inconvenience and even an irrelevance. It's quite notable how visible or not Brian Cookson is at the Tour de France. I saw him in Dusseldorf on day one, didn't see him again at the Tour de France. Odd that the UCI president isn't more visible at the world's biggest bike race.
But that's always been the way, to be fair, hasn't it, really?
It's always been the way, but it was the way under the previous regime because of the bad relationship between ASO and Pat McQuaid, I think. In the Don't Know column, doping, we've spoken about a lot. There haven't been a lot of doping cases, so we don't know whether that's because there isn't as much doping or because there isn't enough investigations of doping and discoveries of doping positives, etc. And motors, because that's been an issue as well. The suspicion that motors are used in bikes. Something that certainly come to the forefront under Brian Cookson's leadership. That's pretty much my very quick and too quick analysis of Brian Cookson's presidency.
Yeah, Rich, you mentioned there the context in which Brian Cookson came to power, and it was 2013, wasn't it? And it was really still in the wake of the Armstrong fallout, and it was at a time when I think cycling and the people that follow cycling were sick to the back teeth of doping stories primarily, and this constant drama that there seemed to be around the UCI, and I think Brian Cookson at that time, as well as being one of only two candidates and the anti Pat McQuaid, I think he was seen as someone who could dial down some of the drama. But I think in a sense that has been his undoing, because as the doping issue has faded from prominence, there's almost a kind of numbness, I think, has set in. And, we've not, as you said, we've not seen a lot of Brian Cookson. We haven't seen him at the Tour de France. We haven't seen him a lot generally. And we haven't seen that much evidence of strong positions from him. And I remember this is one thing that, one doubt that I had and other people had when he came to power, and he immediately started talking in terms of independence and transparency and an awful lot of delegation. So creation of commissions and, you know, re-establishing the independence of certain areas within the UCI. But what seemed to be lacking was a kind of ideology, in a way, and a kind of any sort of strong statements from him. And we pressed him on this. I remember we did an interview with him in, I think, just after he took over the presidency. And I wasn't particularly satisfied or wasn't particularly convinced by the response he gave. But this is something I've heard from riders and people involved in cycling over the last few years, that you know, no one would advocate a return to the bad old days of Hein Verbruggen, for example, but with someone like Hein Verbruggen, who was almost an emperor figure, you at least knew where you stood, because he was, his position on particular issues really eclipsed any other noises or any other sort of philosophy coming out of the UCI. He was the UCI in effect, and that has been lacking with Brian Cookson. And purely from a PR point of view, from his personal point of view, I think the lack of any real strong statements and any real strong markers or attempts to build his legacy have been notable in the last year, when, you know, he has been campaigning and he has been trying to gain re-election, and if anything, he's faded even further from view over the last 12 months or so. And we're about an hour into the podcast and we haven't mentioned football once, but my favourite football team is managed by a gentleman called Arsene Wenger, and one of the criticisms often levelled at Arsene Wenger is that he manages Arsenal like he's going to manage it for the rest of time. And I think that at times it seemed like Brian Cookson was managing, governing the UCI as though he was going to be in power from here until eternity.
But that greyness was part of the attraction, wasn't it? He was almost like John Major to Margaret Thatcher. And, you know, that was... Because it's hard to separate McQuaid and Verbruggen. So we can sort of bracket them together and say that after that regime, the sport needed somebody... in the mould of Cookson.
It did, Rich. And again, I'm sorry to have to talk about football again, but someone made a very good point to me on Twitter. It's a bit like the perennial, the eternal search for the perfect England football manager. They tend to oscillate between, you know, a hot-headed Englishman and a laid-back foreigner, or, you know, they go from one pole to the other. And, you know, Brian Cookson seemed like a good option at that point. And also, you know, I've seen some people balk at the idea of a British backlash having been Brian Cookson's undoing. However, I do think that in 2013, when Brian Cookson was elected, British cycling and brand Britain in cycling was surfing the crest of a wave. And I think some of the sheen has come off that in the last few years, notably because of the we'll call it the Jiffy bag scandal, but other things as well. There's also a certain boredom, a certain apathy that's set in with the sort of swell of British power and British force, both among riders and teams and on an administrative level.
Well, I mean, I'm still quite keen to talk to Brian, and I think we'll catch up with him at some point later in the year. You said, Richard, you know, I'd been trying to get Brian to make himself available for an interview, really in light of everything blowing up with Bradley Wiggins and the Jiffy bag, and obviously, you know, the allegations of a bullying culture at British Cycling, because that all happened on Brian Cookson's watch. He was president of the British Cycling at the time that happened, and his kind of failure to really address that in any way and just kind of go to ground and hope that it would just all kind of blow over, I think, but came to symbolise the way that he was. Certainly, he changed in the sense that, you know, he'd come in saying, "Well, we're going to be transparent. We're going to front up to some of these things." And then there was a great opportunity to do exactly that, and he didn't really do it. And whether or not that had any bearing on the delegates' decision when they came to vote, I doubt it did. But certainly, in terms of the way the public have seen Brian Cookson's time as UCI president, I think that's had an influence. But I think the other thing is, you know, we've talked about this a lot today, but also a lot over the years, the position of the UCI president, I mean, the focus on it is disproportionate, really, to its importance in world sport. I mean, not even Sepp Blatter, when he was president of FIFA, sort of attracted quite the same level of, certainly not from football fans, the same level of sort of criticism. I think there's always been a belief that, you know, anything that goes wrong in cycling, you know, the president of the UCI must carry the can for that. But really, it's a kind of a managerial position. It's a figurehead position. There are so many committees and that's set up to look after all the different aspects of the sport. I think that what Brian Cookson failed to do really was to restate the UCI's purpose. What is it there for? I think the CERT report was a good step towards that, but Richard, as you said, the failure to kind of publicly follow up on that, it leaves a kind of gaping hole. The UCI ends up lumbered with all the kind of the odds and ends of cycle sport. When you look at the website, it's got a small stake in the elite end. That it organises the world championships, and even there it makes a ham-fisted effort of it sometimes. Even just last week, not giving the women the same level of course for the time trial as the men, for example. And I think that's a pattern that's going to be repeated as it stands in Innsbruck next year. I mean, it's just like learning at a glacial pace. And really, that's what comes from the leadership and from the very top. A failure to kind of get a grip of those things and change that culture quickly enough. I accept he's made some big steps forward with the Women's World Tour, but again, as a governing body, in terms of, and I'm mindful of Daniel's point that the UCI isn't just there to look after men's elite road racing, and sometimes we lose sight of that. But they don't really organise anything, and the thing they do organise, the calendar, is an absolute mess, and they seem absolutely incapable of sorting that out and creating flagship.
And Lionel, there seems to be a real lack of any ideology, any long-term vision, any kind of vision or desire to shape professional cycling in any particular way. It seems very fickle, very reactionary. They'll go where the best money is or the best opportunity arises at any particular time. But there is no long-term view of what it ultimately should look like and how that marries with the financial imperatives of the teams and the riders.
Which, for all his faults, Hein Verbruggen had a vision, didn't he?
He did.
For cycling in the 1990s, and he changed it. And not necessarily for the better, and certainly there were huge failures on his watch, and he ended up with too much power. But it's a tricky balancing act, and it does come down to power. And this is something that's maybe changed more, accelerated in recent years. But ASO, the organisers, have all the power. Now, there's an assumption that La Passion is close to ASO, largely because he's French, I think. And I think that might be a misplaced assumption. I don't know really the nature of his relationship with ASO, but ultimately ASO will act in ASO's interests, and I'm not sure there'll be huge changes there. Just a word on, there was always an assumption that Brian Cookson was very close to Dave Brailsford from Team Sky. He did serve on the board at Team Sky, but he and Brailsford are not close and haven't been close during his time as UCI president at all. And it's very easy to make these assumptions based on nationality and previous relationships and links, but they're not always accurate. So La Passion, he has a whiff of Emmanuel Macron about him, doesn't he? Young, dynamic looking, wears a nice suit.
Dire start to his presidency? No, not yet.
Well, yeah, he must go. La Passion must go. But already, on that issue of a minimum salary for men at World Tour and Pro Conti level and not for women, it's already, you can see a bit of a backlash to that, because they are running under the La Passion regime has begun. He's assembled his management committee. Bob Stapleton, your old pal, is on that. A return to the front line for Bob Stapleton. Tracy Godfrey is still there. Igor Makarov is there. He's the man the Russian who, of course, backed Cookson and backed La Passion this time around. So that's the management commission is doing its work, and we'll see what happens. I mean, Bob Stapleton, Daniel, obviously he returned to the front line a year or so ago at USA Cycling. You surprised to see him back?
Not really, because I saw him at the Tour de France in July, and we spoke about it, and we actually spoke then about the election, and he thought then that it was quite hard to call. He thought it might be quite close, but I think he was certainly in the camp of those people who were slightly disappointed by Cookson and had quite high hopes for Cookson, and felt that he'd not really been strong and forceful enough, particularly in the latter half of his presidency. I think there were encouraging signs in the first year or so, but this was something that came out last week after the elections. A few people mentioned this, that they thought that his will and his kind of oomph had, if anything, slowly dissolved away over the course of his presidency.
Well, Emmanuel Macron spent €26,000 apparently on makeup during the first 3 months of his presidency. So I suppose it's our job to keep an eye on Le Parisien's makeup expenditure.
Well,
as UCI president,
I'm going to be studying his face very closely when we see him. Yeah, definitely. That's an interesting one. Well, listen, we should wrap things up. I'm sure we'll return to this and other topics. But that's all I think for this week. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.